thank you for downloading this episode of Radio Grimbald from RadioGrimbald.com. I am your host, Goldine Ogawa, and welcome to the fifth episode of Radio Grimbald. Welcome and happy holidays! It's a little hectic around here. Maybe you can hear some of the holiday cheer going on in the background in the studio here. Happy holidays. It's always difficult to know exactly what to say, you know, because there's so many different holidays. And, you know, sometimes you just want to say, you know, like, happy winter. And then, of course, my friends in Brazil and Australia get angry with me. So, happy holidays. Happy holiday of your choice. Whichever holiday you choose to celebrate. I hope you have a happy one. And if I seem a little distracted, it's because it is the holidays. And that means my entire family has descended upon me and is crammed into the Radio Grimbald studios and is making dinner and talking and getting the dog excited. So hopefully not too much of that is going to show through in this recording. But if I seem a little distracted, it's because there's a lot going on and I'm recording this. I'm snatching a few moments to record this podcast for you. Cat, stop torturing the dog. Oh, good grief. This week, I am reading The Piper in the Dell. It's a short story that I wrote for my Fiddler's Dream and Other Stories collection. I hope you like it. The Piper in the Dell. Copyright 2011 by Goldine Ogawa. The girl's name was Annabel. She sat in the back of a battered sedan and watched as her father tried to wrestle open the gate across the driveway of their new home. She didn't think much of it. A tiny, battered cottage with peeling white paint and ivy all up one side. It sat at the base of a sloping hill covered in green wheat, which cut across the blue sky like a brushstroke in a painting. It looked lonely, but wasn't really. It had originally been a shepherd's house and part of a larger farm, which still kept horses on the other side of the hill. But the owners had been cutting back over the last century, and they had sold the cottage to a rich man in the city who rented it to people like Annabel's parents, people who had gotten tired of cramped city life and wanted instead to enjoy cramped country life. Annabel wrinkled her nose at the cottage. It was hardly any bigger than their nice downtown flat and much dirtier looking. The farm, which it had once been a part of, was called Spring Dimple Farm, and so the cottage was called Spring Dimple Cottage. When Annabel first heard this, she thought she would be sick. Now that she could see the cottage, she knew she would be. "And then it shall be even more of a mess," she thought. There was an angry, ripping sound as decades of old-growth vines let go their hold on the gate, and Annabel's father dragged it open. "There we are, just needed a friendly nudge," he called back, gesturing for Annabel's mother, who was driving, to bring the car in. Annabel's father was tallish and thinnish and wore suits, even when he was pulling open vine-covered gates. He had large, dark eyes, which Annabel had inherited, and perfect dark hair, which she hadn't. She had got her mother's caramel-coloured hair, but instead of it being glossy and curly like her mother's, it was frizzy and wild and stuck out in all directions. She had also inherited her mother's coppery skin, and of this she was glad. Her father got all pink and burned whenever they took holidays to the seaside, or just looked like pasty, uncooked dough when at home. Annabel's mother wore sensible clothes in bright colours. She was a civil engineer and worked with a large company building bridges and roads and other important things. Annabel's father used to be a schoolteacher. He had retired when Annabel's mother had got a promotion, but he still hadn't gotten out of the habit of wearing sombre-coloured suits and ties. He said he did this because it made his students respect him. Annabelle thought it made him look like a government agent. When they had decided to move to be closer to Annabelle's mother's job, Annabelle's father had quit teaching and decided what he really wanted to do was be a stay-at-home dad and a writer. Annabelle had stared at him in horror. "But don't you see, this will be great," he had said. "You won't have to go back to school during midterm. You'll have the rest of spring and summer to make friends. In fact, now that I'll be at home all day, I don't see why you need to be packed off to school at all." And he had hurried happily away to research homeschooling. Annabelle was miserable. She liked her old friends at her old school and didn't want to become a friendless outsider. But her mother had agreed with her father, and so she had been enrolled in a homeschooling transition course to finish term, with the understanding that, come fall, she could take any form of home curriculum her parents pleased. Her father was very excited about this. He wanted to try out his natural selection style of teaching, which he had wanted to use on his own class for years, but the school hadn't let him. So as the car pulled into the drive at Spring Dimple Cottage, Annabelle glared at what was to become her prison. She would be stuck at home with Dad. Wonderful. "I shall probably just play video games and get even fatter," she thought, leaning up against the window and making ugly faces at the side of the building. But then she saw something. The movers had been there the day before, and they had left her bicycle leaning against a rose bush, obviously unsure where to put it. Her bicycle probably needed oil on its chain and air in its tires, but she could use it to cycle down to the village and do... what? Maybe there would be a cinema. Annabelle had wanted to go right after breakfast. Anything to get out of that stuffy old cottage. But there was no one to fix her bicycle. Her mother had left for work, and her father was writing. He had read somewhere that you ought to write at least 1,000 words a day or for an hour, and he was determined to start then and there. He came down after 15 minutes, pulling on his coat. "I couldn't think of anything to write," he said cheerfully. "Come on, let's fix that bike." Annabelle's father was an avid cyclist. That was why she had a bicycle at all. He had bought her one, hopefully, on her 11th birthday. But Annabelle hated cycling. Hated any form of exercise, really. It spoke volumes for her dissatisfaction with her home that she would consider using a bicycle as a means of escape. Her father, happily oblivious to her true motives, thought the vibrant spring scenery and country air was beginning to work on her already, and happily lubed up the chain, filled the tires with air, and strapped a spare pump to the frame. "Just remember to stay off the main roads," he told her as he wheeled it out in front of the cottage. "And don't forget your helmet."
"Yes, father,"
Annabelle said sarcastically through her nose. She clipped her helmet on, vowing as she did so to take it off first chance she got. Her father stood at the gate, waving, until Annabelle was out of sight around a curve in the road. But Annabelle did not look back. She was free. And for the first few minutes it was glorious. The road wended its way gently downhill, following the contours of a river. She passed through the village of Lower Flaxhead, but there was nothing there but a church, a pub, and some severe houses with perfectly manicured rose gardens in front. So she went on. Then something horrible happened. The road turned and began to go uphill.
"Oh, I shall die!"
Annabelle wailed, resting on her handlebars and staring at the strip of road ahead of her. Worst of all, she realized, to go home she would have to climb back up the hill she had just descended. Unless... she was at a crossroads. Annabelle hadn't realized it before because the other road was only a tiny lane. On a post made of weathered wood, almost swallowed up by a vigorous jasmine bush, were a series of signs. To Lower Flaxhead, on the one pointing back the way she had come. To Eston upon Arvo, pointing to where she had been going, and the sign pointing down the lane said, To Spring Nipple Farm, Piper's Dell. The lane looked nice and shady and flat, Annabel thought, and she was suddenly seized with curiosity about the farm her cottage had once been a part of. Besides, they raised horses at Spring Dimple Farm. Annabel liked horses. Feeling much better, she set off down the lane. This turned out to be a mistake, for soon the lane turned and began to go uphill as well. But Annabel could see that it only went up to the top of the same long green hill that sat behind her cottage, and as she could see the top, she knew it wasn't far. She had to get off her bike and push it. Eventually she took off her helmet as well. It was a much longer hill than it looked, and she was sweating heavily by the time she reached the top. A stiff wind blew along the ridge of the hill, rustling the leaves of the line of trees that escorted the lane down the other side. Annabel could see a cluster of houses at the bottom of the hill, surrounded by a complex of pastures and green gallops. A few coppery horses, coats glistening in the sun, dotted the hillside. Someone was singing. Far away down the hill, the music came wafting up to Annabel in snatches, so she couldn't make out the words. Almost as if in response, the wind died down. Without the gusting in her ears, Annabel realized it wasn't singing. It was a pipe. Someone was playing a pipe down on Spring Dimple Farm. Forgetting her helmet, she kicked her bike into motion and set off down the hill. It was a long, steep hill, steeper than the one she had just climbed, for Spring Dimple Farm was set in a lowland of the surrounding hills. The road turned sharply at the bottom into a cluster of houses, and Annabel had to brake hard. She had lost the music. Disappointed, she pedaled past a farmhouse with a white picket fence, a barn half full of hay, and a manure pile. Here, the sealed lane ended, and it turned into a gravel-covered track. There was another wooden signpost, more conspicuous this time since it stood out in the open. Annabel pulled up beside it. To Flaxhead pointed back toward the hill. To Stanton Leaning pointed along the gravel track. There had been a third arm, but this appeared to have been broken off. Nevertheless, some enterprising person had tacked a round plastic plate to the post, and Piper's Dell was written on this in uncertain green marker. And there was an arrow, also in green, pointing. Annabel looked. It didn't seem to be pointing at much. A narrow green path led off around the curve of a hill. It looked like the kind of path one would ride a horse on, or one of those bicycles with big, knobby tires. Annabel's bicycle had sleek, narrow tires, perfect for riding on asphalt or concrete, but not very good for anything else. Music. The sound of a single pipe, wobbling like a bird, came drifting down the green path. Annabel got off her bike and pushed it toward Piper's Dell. A dell, Annabel had once been told, was a kind of small valley. And indeed, the narrow green path led into just such a valley formed between the cleft of two swelling hills. On either side were trees, closing in on the sky, so the place felt even smaller than it actually was. A stream flowed along the bottom, and it was from beside this stream, perched on a mossy bank over a dark green pool, that the piping originated. Annabel had to stop and stare, for what sat beside the pool was unlike anything she had ever seen before. If you took a golden brown rabbit and stretched it into more or less the shape of a human, gave it a flowing brown tail and extra large feet, you would have something very much like what sat beside the pool playing a fife. It wore a vivid sky-blue coat and short maroon trousers that stopped at the ankle, but because most of its leg was foot, like a rabbit or a kangaroo, this meant they stopped less than halfway down. Beside it, on the moss, was a purple-peaked cap with a fluffy pink feather stuck in the band and containing, for it was upside down, a fine collection of mushrooms. All this Annabel took in while the strange creature played, and as it did so, thrushes and finches fluttered in and landed on the moss beside the hat. A real rabbit crept out of a bush and sat up on its hind legs, its long ears perked forward. To Annabel, the music seemed to swing back and forth between a kind of windy whistle and a trilling warble that reminded her of running water. It quite distracted her from the small menagerie of animals which had clustered around the player. At last the creature finished, and for a moment after the pipe left its cleft mouth, the music continued to hang in the air, as if the wind and the water had been singing along and hadn't noticed that the song had stopped.
"I say!" exclaimed Annabel. "Are you the piper, then?"
The animals scattered. There was a chaos of flapping wings and angry shrieking of surprised birds. The rabbit bolted, upsetting the creature's hat and sending mushrooms everywhere. The creature looked around, a little perplexed, and Annabel saw it wore a monocle, which glinted in the sunlight and made one of its brilliant purple eyes look even bigger than the other.
"Well, that wasn't very nice, frightening my audience," the creature said.
It had a highish, clear voice, but with a distinctive edge that made Annabel certain it was male.
"I don't know who you think you are, young lady, but you clearly could use a lesson in hush."
Annabel cringed. Whatever this creature was, he was clearly very magical, and Annabel did not want to offend him.
Sorry, she mumbled.
The piper got up, brushing twigs and stray leaves off his coattails, and his real tail, and began collecting the scattered mushrooms.
"Oh, it is a small matter, I suppose," he said. "They leave when I am finished anyway. Who are you?"
I'm Annabel,
said Annabel. The piper paused in his picking and squinted at her through his monocle.
"Funny sort of bell," he remarked. "You look like a girl." "I am a girl," Annabel said, beginning to feel annoyed. "Annabel's my name."
The piper stood up, which made him almost the same height as Annabel. He looked her over.
"'Tis your name, if so you claim, but to me it's not the same," he announced,
then twirled around and grabbed the last mushroom from where it teetered on the brink of the moss. Annabel was flabbergasted.
"Well, what's yours, then?"
The creature seemed to like the question. He puffed his chest out and his ears stood erect, adding a good foot and a half to his height.
"I am Tobias Leander, the piper in the dell. My eyes are made of lavender. Your secrets I can tell."
He looked down at himself, frowned.
"Not tell your secrets to others," he added. "That would be rude. I mean, I can tell what they are. Why are you so miserable?"
Annabel had actually been feeling progressively less and less miserable since she had been in the dell, but now she was reminded of how she had no friends, of how she would never make any more friends, how her new home was cluttered and smelly, not to mention the hill she had to climb to get there. Her face fell. Tobias Leander looked at her expectantly. Annabel took a deep breath.
"My stupid mum and dad decided to move, without asking me, I'll have you know, and now Dad wants to keep me at home to learn things instead of going to school where my friends are. There's nothing to do except watch telly and play Super Sergio because Dad won't buy me the new catch creature game, even though I said I'll pay him back in chores. But the cottage is all musty and old and smells of mildew, so I've tried going out, but there are hills, and I'm fat, and everything is so unfair, and...
She could feel a lump rising in her throat, and she squeezed her eyes shut. She would not stop crying, not now. Tobias Leander blinked his large purple eyes at her. He put his head on one side, thoughtfully, and regarded the little girl in front of him. She was, it must be said, rather roundish, but not terribly so. He sighed.
I think, he said decisively, what you need is a nice cup of hot tea and some fresh baked biscuits.
Annabel gulped.
My friends at Stanton Leaning make very good biscuits, Tobias Leander continued, and I promise to visit them soon. Would you like to come?
Annabel was taken aback.
You don't mind? She asked. Not at all. Not at all, said Tobias Leander, bowing over his hat.
He started off along the green path, leading deeper into the dell. Annabel pushed her bike after him. Annabel's parents had driven through Stanton Leaning on their way to Spring Dimple Cottage. Annabel remembered because there was supposed to have been an ancient monument in Stanton Leaning, but she had not been able to spot it. Just a lot of small houses, an old church, and a broken-down-looking pub. She had been disappointed. The way Tobias Leander took to Stanton Leaning was very different. At first, Annabel thought they were going in entirely the wrong direction. But finally the green track emerged from the dell, and she found herself up on the rolling gallops she had seen from the hill above Spring Dimple Farm. And she could look across them, and there was Stanton Leaning. It looked a good deal smaller, and there was the distant rush and whir of motorcars and lorries travelling along the main road that bypassed the town. From where Annabel and Tobias Leander stood, they looked like little toy cars, and the town looked like a collection of little toy buildings. Between them and the town stretched an expanse of grassy plain, undulating lazily into dips and dells. There was one wide green track which crossed straight over, heading in the direction of Stanton Leaning. As they made their way along it, Tobias walked in a sort of bouncing hop, Annabel pushed her bike. She began to notice odd bumps in the otherwise smooth hills. They were covered with tufty grass, and some looked a little uneven, as if bits had been carted away and the rest fallen over. One stood right next to the track, and as they passed, a flock of crows took flight, cawing and cackling at the two travellers. Annabel was surprised, but Tobias Leander laughed and waved at the birds, calling to them. And, to Annabel's amazement, the entire flock wheeled around and flew back to them, alighting on the grass and on the fence.
"Hello, hello!"
Tobias Leander said, making a bow to the nearest and biggest bird. This bird was so much bigger and so much shaggier than all the others, Annabel thought it must not be a crow at all, but a raven.
"Good to see you, my fine friend," Tobias Leander was saying. "Is your king awake yet?"
No. How inconsiderate. He knew I was coming. Leave your bicycle, Annabel girl. No one will take it.
This last was directed over his shoulder, for Tobias Leander had vaulted the wire fence and gone scrambling up one side of the hill. A little confused, and wondering who this king was, Annabel leaned her bike against the nearest fence post and squeezed through between the wires. It was a tight fit, and she nearly left a piece of her shirt in it. When she looked back, the big black bird was perched protectively on the handlebars. That was all right, then. Her father would be very disappointed if her bicycle was stolen. Tobias Leander was waiting for her halfway up the little mound. He had his pipe out again and had taken off his monocle. He was polishing it. When Annabel arrived, he handed it to her.
"Best to wear this and not pay overmuch care to what you see with your uncovered eye," he said. "The king is a fine fellow, but he can be a bit grumpy when he wakes up."
"The king? What king?"
Annabel asked, holding up the monocle to her left eye. Things did not look much different through it, save a little blurred around the edges.
"Why, the king who sleeps in this barrow here," Tobias Leander said. And he put the pipe to his lips and played.
It was nothing like the music Annabel had heard in the dell earlier. This sounded ancient, of faraway sunrises and lost, mournful mornings. But the really remarkable thing was what the sound did to the earth in front of them. It made a door. At least Annabel was fairly certain there had not been a door there before. Now there was, and it looked like it was made of light. Tobias Leander pulled it open and ushered Annabel into the earth. At first everything was blinding black, and she could not see a thing. Then a low greenish light spread throughout the chamber, for chamber it was. A domed chamber whose floor was far lower than the ground outside. Annabel nearly tripped as she stumbled down the loose, earthy embankment. At the bottom was a stone slab which stretched from her feet to the far end of the burrow. And on the slab... This was where things got confusing. With her bare eye, all Annabel saw was a cairn of stones. With the eye that looked through Tobias Leander's monocle, there was a man. If he had been standing, he would have been huge, as tall as a house. Tall enough, Annabel reckoned, to ride astride an elephant, as if it were his pony. His monstrous feet, which were nearest to her, had huge leather sandals strapped to them, and from what she could see of the rest of his body, he was lying on his back, he wore a heavy woolen tunic that came down to his bare knees, and was embroidered all over with twisty rope-like patterns and had pieces of metal sewn in strips along the sides. It reminded Annabel of the old Kyrick designs she saw on Baronian dancing dresses, only somehow older, more angular, more handmade. While Annabel stood and stared, Tobias Leander bounced up onto the slab, Annabel had to cover her other eye since it looked too confusing otherwise, and sat on those huge sandaled feet. "I'm very sorry to wake you," he said in a clear, piercing voice, "but it's almost time for tea. I would be very much obliged if you'd join Annabel and me." For a moment there was silence. Then, with a shifting, grinding sound, the man sat up. He was so tall his head nearly brushed the ceiling, and so wide he filled the barrow from side to side. Annabel found herself backing away from him, but she ran into the earth wall and had to stop. The king wore a crown. It was hard to see at first because it was tangled in his wild grey hair, but it seemed to be made of some dark green metal that glinted copper. He wore a band of twisted metal around his neck that ended in large round balls. A torque, Annabel thought it was called. Aside from this, he wore no jewellery at all, unless you counted the metal cuffs around his wrists, which Annabel didn't. In a windy, rumbling voice, the giant spoke.
"Who wakes us from a slumber?"
Annabel, who was still flattened against the side of the barrow, wished she could sink right into the earth.
"I do," said Tobias Leander cheerfully, hopping up to perch next to the king's giant right hand. "You made a promise to come out for tea, and I am seeing that you keep it. So hop, hop." He clapped his furry, paw-like hands. "They'll have the blankets laid out in Staunton Leaning by now."
"Easy there, wee Fifer,"
said the king, rubbing his head where the crown sat.
"I cannot wake as nip as thee."
He had a strange sort of accent, Annabel thought, like a northern drawl tumbled together with something distinctly foreign. Or very, very ancient. Then he noticed Annabel.
"Sir Fifer, what hast thou brought us near?"
"This is Annabel,"
Tobias Leander said, swinging his arm wide. Then he brought it in close and whispered to the king behind his paw.
"But she is really a girl."
"I ken that, Fifer,"
the king said, cocking a bushy eyebrow at Tobias Leander. Then he looked straight at Annabel, both dark eyes like pools reflecting distant moonlight. They seemed very old, Annabel thought, and sad, and kind.
"Well, 'tis a bonny day that brings nee kin," the king said, his face crinkling in a sort of smile.
Then he shrugged.
"Away a bit while we open the wither door."
And so saying, he drew his bare knees up to his chest and putting his hands above his head, he stood up. The top of the barrow split down the middle and crumbled away to either side like blankets being pushed off a bed. Sunlight streamed in, and for a moment Annabel was blinded all over again. She shut her eyes tight and pointed her face straight into the light, hoping in this way to adjust her eyes more quickly. But when she opened them, she found she could still only see in vague, white, blurry shapes. Then she realized that Tobias Leander's monocle had fallen from her eye. Fortunately, it still dangled from its chain, and she felt for it with her hand and brought it up to her left eye. With her right eye, she could still see nothing. But with her left, she saw very well indeed. They were at the top of a low green hill. The same hill, she realized, that they had been on before Tobias Leander led her into the barrow. But now there was no barrow, no green track. The little dollhouses of Stanton Leaning were gone, and so was the sound of traffic. There were no roads, no power lines, nothing at all of the modern world. Now, it was all empty green downs and clear, uncluttered skies falling onto a smooth horizon. Where the town of Stanton Leaning had been, there was a circle of 12 or so giant standing stones, only they were all leaning heavily to one side or the other, like trees bending before a heavy wind. A shadow fell across her face, and looking up she found it was cast by the arm of the Giant King, who was stretching himself. Against the sun he seemed only half there, the shape of a man, lit around the edges by a golden halo. Tobias Leander bounded over and sprang up onto the king's shoulder and perched there, like a parrot. Tapping the king on the ear, he whispered a few words, and a moment later the king stooped down so his craggy face was level with Annabel's. He extended one huge hand. Annabel looked from the hand to Tobias Leander, who smiled encouragingly. Taking a deep breath, she grabbed the king's thumb, which was as wide as her forearm, and the king gently lifted her up until she was able to scramble onto his other shoulder. "Hold on tight," Tobias Leander said, grinning ear to ear. "He walks fast."
"I walk as fair as any in my clan," said the king, and he strode off across the plain.
It had been a long time since anyone had carried Annabel on their shoulders, and the girl couldn't help squealing as the king lurched into motion. It was not at all how she remembered, more like sitting on a steep, swaying mountain. She dug her fingers into the king's embroidered robe and wrapped one arm around his neck. It was a most shocking way to treat a king, she thought, but then she had a feeling that this king was not like the one from her time. When he had been properly alive, there had been much fewer people around, and so he was used to doing things for them rather than the other way around. The stones of Stanton Leaning slowly grew bigger and bigger until Annabel wondered how she could have missed them when they drove through the town earlier. Now that the houses were gone, replaced by a field of grass dotted with daisies, she saw they made up a circle that was more or less the size of the village, with three in the centre forming the corners of a triangle. All of these were leaning to some degree, and one was bent almost right over. There was activity among the stones. Little furry figures were appearing out of holes in the ground, carrying bundles and pushing wheelbarrows. They were all heading for the three stones in the centre, and when they arrived, they laid their burdens down and waited. They were waiting for the king, Annabel realized as he strode ponderously into the ring of leaning stones. As he approached, the crowd around the central three all bowed low, and the king raised a hand in greeting. Then he leaned over. Annabel had to scramble to stay on his shoulder, but Tobias Leander swayed and balanced effortlessly, and putting his hands around the lowest leaning stone, he pulled it upright again. Then he went round and provided the same treatment to the others. A cheer went up from the crowd down on the ground, and the bundles were whipped out and the wheelbarrows overturned. Someone struck up a tune on a fiddle and a lute, and a moment later the entire congregation had burst into spontaneous dance. Annabel slid down the king's arm when he too began to sway solemnly to the music, and she scurried off to hide behind one of the standing stones. Careful to keep Tobias Leander's monocle to one eye and the other tight shut, she peered around the stone, staring at the dancers. They were not quite human, but they were not quite Annabel either. Some of them were foxish, others more mousy. A few looked rather like Tobias Leander, only with shorter tails. They all had twinkling black eyes and wore greenish-brown clothes, which made it somewhat difficult to spot them on the rare occasions when they held still. The dance they did was wild, chaotic, and yet purposeful. As they danced, they grabbed cloths and bundles of food, and they laid out blankets and set up tables. A few hooked arm in arm and danced in a ring, going faster and faster until they fell down panting and laughing. In the center of the ring was now a smouldering fire. There was a brush of whiskers against her cheek, and Annabel whipped round to find Tobias Leander leaning over her shoulder, smiling sunnily. "Tell me, Annabel, are you a player or a dancer?" he asked. Annabel did not know what to say. She did not dance, that was certain, and aside from two disastrous piano lessons when she was six, she hadn't played an instrument in her life. Tobias Leander took his little fife from inside his coat and grinned. "It's never too late to begin something new," he said, and began to play. Tentatively, Annabel peered out from behind her stone. All the other dancers appeared to be having so much fun. There was a flurry of fur and long ears, and a herd of rabbit-like people came thundering in from the outer ring of stones. They carried earthenware jars and strings of dried berries, and they caught Annabel up in their stampede. And, for the first time in her life, Annabel found herself dancing. It was actually quite fun. She didn't feel at all embarrassed, as she had feared she would, and she didn't grow short of breath or fall over, either. She helped the rabbit people set up the jars in a long line on a table that a couple of badgers had erected. Then she was whisked off by a set of foxes to set out little square cushions to sit on. And all this was done in a bouncing, boisterous way, filled with lots of leaping and twirling. It was as though the music got into their legs and carried them along. And then everything was ready, and the music stopped. It did not stop all at once. First the fiddle died away, then the lute, and then there was just the sweet melody of Tobias Leander's pipe guiding them down. The dancers came back to themselves to find a magnificent picnic had been laid out upon the grass among the righted standing stones. There were biscuits and scones, muffins, breads and jams, and little meat pies. There were baskets of fruit and jars of good things to drink. There was a kettle of boiling water over the fire, and a portly badger wearing a red fez was doling it out into cups. Annabel suddenly found she was extremely hungry, and she went around grabbing cakes and biscuits almost at random. Everything tasted good in a rough, nutty, fresh-baked sort of way. She stayed clear of the fruits, though, since they were odd shapes and glistened in a way that she did not like. She did have a cup of tea, which the badger in the fez gave to her with a twinkling smile. Eventually all the dancers found places to sit down with their plates of food and cups of drink. Annabel wound up between a jackrabbit and a tortoise, who were both drinking from cups that smelled strongly of jasmine. She could see the king, looming like a small mountain, off to one side. He raised his cup in a toast and smiled at her. The sun shone down, warming the damp grass, and, after all that exercise and food, Annabel began to feel drowsy. She leaned against the back of the tortoise, lazily taking sips of tea and munching on a blackberry scone. In the distance, she was aware that Tobias Leander got up and began to play again, but this time his music was slow, peaceful, and eventually, combined with the warm sunshine and full belly, lulled Annabel into a deep and contented sleep. She was woken by someone calling. In her sleep, she thought it was a raven, saying goodbye. But as she drifted closer to the surface of wakefulness, she recognized it as a human voice. And it was calling to her. Annabel opened her eyes. At first, things seemed a little offset and blurry, but that was only because she still had Tobias Leander's monocle balanced over one eye. Then she realized she could see out of her other, too, as she sat up and looked around. She had been leaning against the shady side of a high, grass-covered mound, for the sun had passed on and now cast the whole northeast face into shadow. Annabel shivered a little, for the air was strangely chill. The voice called again, and, looking around, Annabel saw that there was the wide green track she and Tobias Leander had traversed earlier. She was back, outside the king's barrow. There were two children on the road, each on a practical, knobby-tired bike, and each maybe a year younger than her. They were stopped next to Annabel's bicycle, which was still leaning against the fence, and they looked agitated, worried even. Annabel got up and walked over to them.
"You must be new round here," said one, a blonde boy with a ruddy face. "You gots to be careful of them barrows," said the other, a girl even darker than Annabel. She stared at her gravely from under a cloud of frizzy black curls. "Don't go climbing on them after dark, and don't stay on the north side. That's how you get taken in."
"Taken in? To where?" Annabel asked, rubbing her eye under the monocle. It didn't seem to be doing much any more, so she took it off. The two children looked at each other in consternation.
"Why, to the land of the dead," said the boy,
as if this were obvious. Annabel looked back at the king's barrow. There was a raven perched on top of it, and it was watching them.
"I don't think that's what happened," she said, frowning.
The two children stared at her. Annabel stared at the raven, which cawed and flew away. As it did so, it felt like something else left the mound as well. Before, there had been a presence watching over her. Now, it was just a mound of earth. She shook herself and turned back to the children. She squeezed back through the fence and picked up her bike.
"What's the easiest way back to Spring Dimple Cottage from here?" she asked with a sigh.
The two children were Elea and Tom, and they lived in Stanton Leaning. They led her back to the village, where Tom showed her on a map the byway that skirted the hill behind Spring Dimple Cottage, so she would not have to climb back up it. Passing through the centre of town, riding their bicycles along a pedestrian path, Annabel stopped and stared. The path ran behind the row of houses and shops that lined the main road, and there, in the beer garden of the broken-down pub, was the triangle of leaning stones, the ones Annabel had visited with Tobias Leander and the king. But now they seemed older, greener, and more worn down. Only two were standing at all. The third was lying flat in the grass. Two teenagers were on it, making out. Thinking Annabel must have stopped because of them, Elea and Tom made faces and mouthed signs of disgust. But Annabel took no notice. She was remembering the giant king, who had righted those stones the last she had seen them.
"Unless it was actually centuries ago," Annabel thought with a shiver.
She wondered who kept knocking them over.
Elea offered to get her mum to drive Annabel home, but Annabel declined. She had things to think about, and felt that being around a grown-up would only push her recent escapade further into the back of her head and make it less real. So she left them at the edge of the village, after promising to ride down and meet them the next day, and began the ride back home in the strong, slanting afternoon sun.
"But it had happened," she thought firmly,
and she put Tobias Leander's monocle safely into her pocket. It was late in the afternoon, and Annabel's father had not got much writing done. He had sat down to write and found he had no ideas, so he had gone to read a book instead. It was supposed, he thought, to be a very good book, but the hero was a writer, and he found that a bit egotistical. What was it with writers and putting other writers in their stories as characters? Couldn't they think of something better for them to be? Really? But he kept reading. From outside, there was the scrape of the garden gate being pushed open, and a moment later the quiet clap of the back door announced Annabel's return. She shuffled into the parlour, where her father was reading, and sat down carefully at the end of the sofa. Her father put down his book and peered at her over his reading glasses.
"How was your day?" he asked. "You were gone for most of it."
Annabel was silent. She still wasn't sure if her day was the sort of thing you shared with a grown-up, if whether she told someone who didn't believe her it would become unreal. But then again, maybe talking about it would solidify the parts that were still shifty in her mind. So she sat and mulled it over. Her father waited patiently. At long last, Annabel spoke.
"If I told you what happened to me today was so incredible you wouldn't believe it, what would you do?"
Her father took off his reading glasses and frowned, untangling his daughter's question. Then he reached for his notebook and pen. He put his glasses back on again. He opened his notebook, flipped to a blank page, and took the cap off his pen. He smiled and seemed relieved.
"Tell me all about it," he said.
Annabel had just got to the bit where Tobias Leander had opened up the side of the Giant King's barrow when there was a sound very much like a cat in the bushes outside the parlour window. Then, with a creak and a scrape, it was pushed open from the outside, and there was Tobias Leander, leaning his upper body into the room, his long ears almost brushing the ceiling.
"Please forgive the untimely intrusion," he was saying, "but I fear I forgot my monocle."
He paused and looked down at Annabel's father, who was staring at him with his pen hovering over his notebook. The curious creature peered down at it, frowning, before bursting into a huge, bright-eyed grin.
"I say," exclaimed Tobias Leander, "am I going to be in a story?"
The end. Tobias, it should be mentioned, has appeared in not one, but two comic books published by Rabbit Valley Comics, and readers who wish to read more of him would do well to go to their website, www.rabbitvalley.com, and search for Tobias and the Golden Dragon and Tobias and the Trial of Tufty Curlicue, respectively. That's Tobias, T-O-B-I-U-S. Astute readers will probably remark on the similarity of the author of those books to the author of this one, and will be gratified to know that they are, despite having different names, one and the same person. It was a strange feeling getting back to painting Tobias with words rather than with watercolors, but I found him as joyful and full of life as ever. He is the sunnier counterpart to this podcast namesake, Grimbald, where she deals with mysterious stories that lurk in the back of our minds at night in the moonlight. Tobias is all sunny afternoons and long naps in grass. The setting for Piper and the Dell was inspired heavily by my experiences in the UK, specifically the unique character of the Salisbury landscape and the real town of Stanton Drew, as seen by bicycle. For travelers in the UK, I highly recommend sightseeing via bicycle. You may not meet Tobias or the King, but if you follow enough byways and look in the right beer gardens, you will probably recognize the inklings from which this story sprang.
And again, The Piper in the Dell, part of the collection Fiddler's Dream and Other Stories, which is an ebook that you can buy for your iPad, iPhone, Android, Nook, Kindle, all sorts of things. You, if you are in the US, UK, France, or Germany, you can buy it on Amazon. If you are in the US, UK, France, Germany, Canada, or Australia, you can buy it on iTunes, and you can go to the respective stores and search for it, or you can go to my website, goldeneogawa.com, and go to the Handy Dandy Books tab, and there you can find all the books that I have for sale as ebooks. Are you done, dog? You're very cute, but you're also very distracting. Will you stop trying to eat my hand while I'm trying to make the podcast for the nice people? This concludes season one of Radio Grimbald. I hope you have enjoyed it. I will be taking some time off for the holidays and to get caught up on my EPUBbing. Coming next year, in January, I'll be continuing Radio Grimbald with season two, which shall feature stories from the first volume of the collected adventures of the magician Bo Ragnar Phelps. I look forward to seeing you then. If you have any feedback, comments, or questions for me, you can send me an email at goldeneogawa, that's goldeneogawa, at gmail.com. And of course, if you are on Twitter, you can tweet at me at GrimbyTweets. And now for something a little special. If you've been listening and enjoying the intro and outro musics that play on every episode of Radio Grimbald, well, you have been enjoying the fine work of one Evan Ogawa, who is, among other things, my brother. And seeing as this is the last episode of season one, I thought it would be fun to play some special music. And so I've asked Evan to loan me some of his other music that I could play on the podcast. And before we get to that, I'm actually going to have him over and we're going to talk a little bit about it. So, hi.
Hello.
Hi, Evan. How are you?
I'm good, thank you.
It is so good of you to come all the way from your room over into my room, braving the perils of the kitchen, which is currently occupied by not one, but two parental units who are making bickering and food.
And food. That's still a good part.
That's the important part, yes. Well, we sound like such spoiled brats, probably. but we're hard at work, too. So the reason I have you over here is we're going to play some more of your music. Unlike the music that goes on every podcast, which I had to wheedle out of you.
Oh.
This is what we're going to be playing. Well, before we get into the music that we're going to play, I wanted to ask you how you ended up being so good at making the musics.
I decided to try it, and I worked really hard at it. Okay, I remember when I was a little kid, I would actually like think about music and try to memorize tunes and stuff. Uh-huh. So I think that might have been part of it. I think it just might have been like an early inclination to just thinking about music.
Yeah, kind of the way I would think about stories, and I'd make Mom write them down because I couldn't read.
Yeah,
I couldn't read or write, so I would dictate them to our mother.
Mm-hmm. I remember doing something like that with our aunt Rachel,
Who, by the way, plays the violin on the theme song. Yeah, she's the violin you hear.
Where I would like catch a song written by someone else, and I'd like ask her to try and figure out what notes they were, and I'd also be like doing it with her at the same time. I was like, and she'd start playing it, and I'd think, wait, is this note right, or is that note right, or is that note wrong?
Uh-huh.
I remember arguing with her a lot about which note was right or wrong.
Yeah, because you apparently have perfect pitch or something. That's serious. I've occasionally had to do some singing, and what we do is, like, I would sing it, and I'd turn to Evan, and be like, okay, you got this note sharp, this note is flat, you accidentally went to a major key, and I have to go back and do it again.
Mm-hmm.
So, but you were entirely self-taught. You had no
I remember.
Lessons.
Well, no formal lessons. I did, like, pick up some books and read them about, like, general music theory and stuff. And eventually I got bored of that. And it's like, you know what? I think I know enough to start writing songs by myself. Oh, yeah. Another thing I did was that I would go, like, download MIDI files of music from video games and analyze those.
All right.
And that kind of helped me learn how to write music.
Mm-hmm. So... So you're more of a composer than a musician. I mean, you mm-hmm. play the piano.
I play the piano. I can... not very well. I'm
better
not,
than me.
Oh. I know enough about... Oh, shoot. I'm just more of a composer type. I can play the piano. I cannot play it well.
Right. So when you compose music, though, you're not using real instruments. You're using the computer. Do you
yes.
want to talk a little bit about how that works? How you make music on the computer?
Well, let's see. I use Logic.
Use Logic!
An application called Logic Pro.
And Logic.
Yeah.
Regular Logic. Mm-hmm. But he also uses Logic, the application.
Yes. And so results may vary for other composers who use the computer for writing their music, but pretty much what I do is I take the mouse and I click on whatever... Well, I don't...
But you're building up all your music in the computer. You're saying, you know, you're sort of basically writing out the music, and then you're saying, okay, this instrument, you play these notes, this
yes.
instrument, you play these notes,
uh-huh.
at this rhythm, at this tempo.
With
you
these
know.
Inflections.
Right.
That's
right.
pretty much what I do.
That's really cool.
Mm-hmm.
And so the music that we're going to play is something that you made with Logic.
Yes.
Yeah. And the song...
Using its come with... software instruments.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You didn't use any... Because it's like you can buy like special instrument samples. Like I believe you have a good Steinway on there.
That came from like the GarageBand kit.
Oh, you went over.
There's like this other application yeah. made by Apple, which is more accessible, called GarageBand. And I got like a whole bunch of instrument packs to go with that. And those carried over into Logic.
Okay. Anyway, this song is it was made in Logic, so even though it sounds like it's a full-blown orchestra, it's just one
yeah.
little computer. I should mention that the music for the podcast that you hear is not done on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
That was done live.
Yes,
that was done live with our aunt on the violin and you on the piano.
Just playing straight flat chords, just going doom doom doom,
which is still more than our Arkandor.
Well,
all right. So this next song is the song I've picked out is the Fex main theme. You want to talk a little bit about Fex? We'll talk a little bit about Fex.
Okay.
Fex, F-E-X, stands for
Fabula X Xenomans.
Which means Fables Out of Strange Minds. And it is a video game that we're working on together.
Yes.
I'm doing the arting and the writing.
You're
doing some of the arting, too.
I'm doing some of the arting, but mostly what I'm doing is the game mechanics.
And the music.
And the music.
Yes, he's doing the game mechanics, but he's also doing the music. And this is the main theme for the game.
This is what you hear. This is what I plan for you to hear when you get to the title screen.
Yeah. And Fex is something, it's still in what, it's like we're past beta. We're like...
It's pre alpha.
Yeah, it's way like, it's like we're excited when we have like a little character we can move around on the screen. Anyway, it's going to be cool. And, yeah, we think it's going to be cool.
Yeah.
Anyway, the music is certainly going to be cool. So that's what we're going to play now. And yeah, I think any last words you want to say about this piece of music? Like what inspired you or
Well, let's see. This was okay, back to where I just pick up lessons about how to do music from like just everywhere. This was like just after I'd heard this person talking about video game music and part of what made like old classic video game songs so wonderfully memorable was that they were made to be catchy
mm-hmm.
and that they had a really strong just single voice melody.
Yeah.
So it's like you know, like think of like catchy songs like the Mario theme or the Halo theme. The thing you notice about them just a single strong melody. It's like not much in the way of like overlapping notes with like multiple voices kind of singing in unison. It's just like this
as
very,
nice as that is.
Yes, it's a very strong, just single voice melody, and you can actually later on the Halo theme there are like a lot of them working together,
yeah.
but each one is just this very strong voice that's very easy to pick out.
Mm-hmm. And so that was sort of what
yes.
you were kind of going for with this one.
Uh-huh.
Okay. Well, that's cool. And we're going to get to that in a second. But first I have to tell you that special thanks for their help in the production of Radio Grimbald go out to Marion Goldine, our wonderful mother. This dude who's sitting right next to me. Say hi, Evan.
Hello.
And our wonderful aunt, Rachel, for creating the theme music. And of course, to you for listening. Radio Grimbald is written, performed, edited, and just about everything, except for the music... else by me. Goldino Gawa. Find out more on the web at RadioGrimbald.com and GoldinoGawa.com. And I nearly forgot. Evan, if people like your music, where can they hear more of it?
They can go to youtube.com/user. It's either user or user. I can't remember the
YouTube. I think you can actually just go to youtube.com/username. What's your username?
Music by Evan.
Just... And we'll put a link on there on the data for the podcast so you can see the link. Yeah. And if they want to email you.
evanogawa@gmail.com.
And I don't have to spell Ogawa because it's the same as my name. And Evan is spelled E-V-A-N. Very easy compared to Goldine. Thank you for listening to us yammer on. And until next year, take care, have fun, and happy holidays, guys. And now...
The title theme for Fabula X Xenomans.
Hope you like it.